Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine one subject that dominates the news, and that is the economy. We will take an in-depth look into the disconnect between economic realities and political possibilities, as it appears increasingly likely that we are heading for a double-dip recession and further painful but totally unnecessary austerity that will result in the impoverishment of millions more Americans than those already out of work, in addition to making life more difficult for a growing majority of our fellow citizens trying to keep their heads above water. Professor of Political Science at York University, Leo Panitch, joins us. He is the author of In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives. And we will talk about alternatives to the defensive retreat of American workers and the middle class who are attempting to hold on to what they have rather than develop new strategies to go on the offensive in a new democratic direction. Joining us now is Leo Panitch, who is Professor of Political Science at York University. He is the co-founder and board member of the journal Studies in Political Economy. His books include Renewing Socialism, Democracy, Strategy and Imagination, Global Capitalism and American Empire and the Political Economy of Global Finance, and the yearly editions of The Socialist Register. His latest book is In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leo Panitch.
Glad to be on here.
Your work is welcome at this time. All I can say is
I appreciate that.
Because there's a huge vacuum on the left here in this country, which is totally puzzling because clearly, the far right of the Republican Party, in the name of the Tea Party, you know, you can argue that they're a manufactured phenomenon, that largely what they call AstroTurf. However, they have captured the Republican Party and moved the national politics way to the right. There is no pushback anywhere, let alone from the far left. There's no pushback from the center or the left in this country. So it is a very strange time. Do you, there from your perch in Canada, looking down at the United States, do you sense this paradox?
Well, of course, one really does. And in many ways, you know, one feels this is as much the left's crisis as a capitalist crisis. And in fact, as one sees that the ruling classes, the banks themselves, have come out with much more political power in this crisis than have ordinary people, the working classes, the middle classes, as they're called in the United States. One really sees that, you know, one can speak of an economic crisis, but in political terms, what one's seeing is in many ways the crisis of the left. And I have to say that it is not simply a matter of the Tea Party in the United States. The weakness of the left is evident in Europe, where social democratic parties are the ones who are implementing austerity. The Greek government is a socialist government, which back in 1980 was had the most radical economic program anywhere in Europe. And in Canada as well, even though we have a social democratic party called the New Democratic Party, which did very well in the last election, it's now the official opposition, the trend is very much to the right. It looks like we're going to be facing a conservative government for a decade. And even that Social Democratic Party in Canada has accommodated itself to the low-tax, anti-tax kind of politics that has proven so effective. Going back to the 80s, this isn't just the Tea Party. This is Reaganism and Thatcherism. It's the tax revolt, which appealed to working-class people and middle-class people who felt that the state wasn't really theirs and that they weren't getting out of the welfare state anything equivalent to what the consumerist advertising was telling them they could get if they held on to their income and purchased things individually rather than opted for collective services.
Well, Leo Panitch, that argument clearly is in the ascendancy here in the United States, but I would have thought in Canada, where you actually have real social democracy and you have a national health service, for example, that it wouldn't have that kind of traction.
Yeah, well, we luckily have held on to what was introduced in the 1960s, our universal Medicare program, which is a wonderful thing, but it is being eroded constantly, and it's in danger of being further eroded now as portions of it are being turned over to private clinics. But, you know, there's no question that having gotten Medicare before the giant pharmaceutical companies and all the private HMOs that now so determine American politics in this area, you know, that having gotten it before they developed their strength has given us certain advantages. But Canada is in no sense a social democratic economy. And as I pointed out, even those European countries that are social democracies have been very much swept up in the last two decades and more, but especially since the crisis, this politics of competitive austerity. They are trapped within the logic of neoliberal capitalism with less and less room for maneuver.
Well, of course, that is what is so puzzling here, that the detachment or the distance between economic realities and the political debate here in the United States. And it has been captured by ignorant ideologues and economic illiterates. We just saw what happened with the manufactured crisis with the debt ceiling, and the compromise that was made, of course, will make it even more difficult for Obama and the Democrats to be reelected, because we know economics 101 is that during a recession that could become a double dip recession, you turn on the spigot, you know, you prime the pump.
The question is, how do you prime the pump? The stimulus that Obama introduced in his first year in office was the largest stimulus since the Depression. The thing about it was that what was needed in order to create jobs in the context of this great crisis was direct government employment. What was done by Roosevelt during the Depression involved, you know, building the dams, the Tennessee Valley Authority, putting newspaper journalists and media journalists directly to work on all kinds of public services. It went all the way from those construction workers to the artists who were put to work by Roosevelt in all kinds of public venues. And that was direct state employment. And that direct state employment then, yes, created the income, which created the basis for increasing consumer demand. It wasn't done nearly enough, even in Roosevelt's time, to prevent a double dip, which indeed occurred in 1937 very seriously. Roosevelt did have a balance the budget mentality himself. But it was done, and that had a great effect, 1935, 1936.
Well, of course.
But you know, what you say when you have stimulus, if you simply are going to be offering people indirect means of consuming, what happens is that the banking system, after this enormous crisis, will not be lending out money to businesses to create more jobs. And in that sense, what we've been caught in is what Keynes defined way back in the 1930s, and Marx foresaw it in the a century before, is a liquidity trap in which no matter how much you induce capitalists to invest, to employ people, they won't, because they think that there's not enough demand out there. So the only way to do it is to have direct state employment. Now, nobody, including the Democrats, has that on their agenda and has had it on their agenda since the 1970s. One needs to remember the extent to which Clinton and Gore and Brown, your governor in California, were part of a shift to the right on the part of the Democratic Party, anticipating Reagan, at a time when left-wing Democrats coming out of the radicalism of the 60s were calling for economic planning, for public housing rather than subprime mortgages, which would get marginalized communities into the housing system by becoming more and more part of finance. That was all turned away, even in the Democratic Party. They've been playing this game themselves of trying to deal with the inequalities of American society through getting people more integrated into capitalism. And it's failed. It isn't just a matter of the Tea Party, and why Obama is so much mixed up and has lost even his articulateness is that one increasingly sees that that politics does not actually provide an alternative to the Tea Party mendacity around taxes. Mm. The only way out of this crisis would have been given the enormous problems with infrastructure in the United States, all the way from the levees in New Orleans to the collapsed bridges in Minnesota, to the decrepit ports in California, is direct state investment in infrastructure. And given that you pay nothing practically in order to borrow money on American Treasury bills, the interest rate is practically zero. Indeed, the argument's right, one could have an enormous deficit. That deficit could have gone towards productive investment undertaken by government, directly employing people, and yes, that would have created the consumer demand.
Again, I'm speaking with Leo Panitch, author of In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives. So there's no question, I think, that politically, you're suggesting that this is the new DLC kind of ideology that's governing the situation.
That's right.
But in terms of pure politics and strategy, what happened was that in spite of Krugman and others arguing that the stimulus wasn't enough, the president dealt with the Republicans. Senator Grassley said, if you make it 40% of it tax breaks and the rest, the 60%, the so-called shovel ready, will go along with it. The White House even gave $15 billion to a congressman to sweeten the deal with him, a Republican, and not one Republican voted for it. He got taken right out of the gate.
Well, I do think the intransigence of the Republican is, if I may say so, partly to do with the degree of intransigence is not just about illiteracy economically. It's not just about the incredible short-sightedness around taxing the rich. It does have to do with this determination not to cooperate with a black president. That's how it looks from outside the United States.
You may well be right, I'm afraid.
And therefore it's not so irrational.
Well, but
except insofar as racism, of course, irrational.
I'd only qualify that, Leo Panitch, by suggesting that the new Republican man on a white horse riding in from Texas, Rick Perry, he's already threatened the chairman of the Fed, Bernanke, by calling him a traitor and saying if he came down to Texas, it'd get real ugly. So they're not just beating up on the black men.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much to make of this. Wall Street remains an enormously powerful force in the United States, and we've had this kind of know-nothingness from Southern and Western governors going back to the 30s. When push comes to shove, the role that the Fed plays in keeping the Treasury bill the measure of the world's value through Wall Street is not going to be something that the American state is going to be pushed off. And it's a bit like Bush having gotten elected saying, we're not going to send our boys to die in some godforsaken part of the earth that most Americans have never heard of, and he was thinking of Somalia. And then he turns around and takes you into two wars into parts of the world that most Americans have never heard of. It's similar to these types of populist politicians at the state level. They make those kinds of statements. They speak of the Federal Reserve as though it's socialist. And then when they're in office, just like any American president gets socialized quickly into being imperialist rather than isolationist, these guys too get socialized very quickly, as Bush did, into having the Federal Reserve play its role as the ultimate guarantor of Wall Street. It's not so much preventing crises as playing the kind of role in financialized capitalism that prevents crises from undoing capitalism when they occur. It's called fire prevention. The U.S. Treasury under Clinton explicitly used that term, that what they are about is firefighters. They put out fires when they occur. They don't prevent them from occurring, but they put them out when they occur. And that's what the Fed's been doing.
But of course, the irony here, Leo, is that the arsonist is rewarded in each case. Let me just to buttress what I was saying in the opening here, that the disconnect between economic realities and people that understand economics and the total failure of our political system to grasp what's happening. Because what's happening to this country is that millions of Americans are being unnecessarily impoverished. And, you know, Americans are hurting other Americans out of some Ayn Randian ideology, like the congressman who wants to eviscerate Medicare, Ryan. You know, he makes his staff read Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. It's all sort of crazy. But one of the smartest guys on Wall Street who predicted the 2008 crash, Nouriel Roubini, was just on the Wall Street Journal. And he brought up the phrase that Marx was right. Let's play that clip.
So, I mean, Karl Marx had it right. At some point, capitalism can self-destroy itself because you cannot keep on shifting income from labor to capital without not having an excess capacity and a lack of aggregate demand. And that's what's happening. We thought that markets work. They're not working. And what's individually rational, every firm wants to survive and thrive, and they're slashing labor costs even more. My labor costs are somebody else's labor income and consumption. That's why it's a self-destructive process. At least in Germany, they did some labor hoarding. In the U.S., we don't believe in it, and we have an employment rate at 16%.
And that was just a clip of Nouriel Roubini on the Wall Street Journal interview describing that Marx is right. And it seems so clear that the transfer from labor to capital has been going on, I guess, since the 70s in this country. It was accelerated under George W. Bush, you know, where capital is clearly the beneficiary of productivity and not labor. That's not sustainable unless we just have to accept that the American dream's over and we're all third world.
Yes, but, you know, Marx and Marxists would have said that Marx was right in the 1950s and 60s, not just at the time of crisis. Roubini is indeed in that interview presenting a very basic insight of Marx, which is that each individual capitalist wants to pay his workers as little as possible, but he wants every other capitalist to pay his workers as much as possible so he has somebody to sell to. And that, you know, irrational, narrow micro-rationality shows that there is no hidden hand in Ayn Randian Adam Smith terms behind the market. There isn't a hidden hand that produces equilibrium. There's a tendency, therefore, to that type of crisis of insufficient demand. It's not the only cause of crisis, but it's one of them. But Marx would have said, Marxists did say in the 1950s and 60s, that the type of reforms, whether they were the New Deal reforms or social democratic reforms that were introduced, were not going to stabilize capitalism. That they would impinge on profits, and they did impinge on profits, and the system is driven by profits. That they would impinge on competition, and if the system is not competitive, it isn't going to introduce new technology and lead to price competitiveness. And that's exactly what did happen. You had a profits crisis. You had the type of regulation that kept airline prices very high. It kept workers, made very difficult for workers to fly. So you got this turn, yes, led by the right, directed against the reforms that had been won, directed against the strength of labor, directed against the regulators who were in bed with the monopoly corporations and their high prices. And they managed to break all of that in order. And they did produce a very dynamic capitalism for two decades. A very dynamic capitalism with the Internet revolution, a capitalism led by the American state that engulfed the whole world. Now, that type of capitalism, being so competitive, not having a hidden hand behind it, produces its own crises. And what people like Roubini and Krugman, et cetera, don't quite get is that it isn't a matter of there being some stable capitalism out there. It's even when you win these reforms within the framework of capitalism, that too is going to produce crises. And that's why Marx wanted something other than capitalism. He wanted democratic economic planning. Now, it's certainly tragically true that when in the name of Marxism, an undeveloped country like the Soviet Union tried to introduce economic planning, they did it in the most horrifically authoritarian manner, very much against what Marx would have wanted. So the trick now is to put on the agenda, and I'm afraid that people like Roubini and Krugman and Stiglitz and the rest of them fail to do it, to put on the agenda how do we move from capitalism, which one way or the other is going to give you eventually crises and class conflict and inequality and irrational competitiveness, how do we move from that to a system of democratic economic planning? And I must say, given that we have an economic crisis overlapping with an ecological crisis, it's inconceivable that we can solve the ecological crisis without having the ability to decide what's invested, where it's invested, how it's invested in a democratic manner.
Well, Leo Panitch, let's take a brief station break here and let's return to the conversation in a moment.
Succeed at last.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Leo Panitch, the author of In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives. Just to add, though, to your analysis, Leo, I would suggest that of course, capitalism is unstable, and it's been more and more so with the boom and busts and these bubbles bursting, and we've seen the series of them with the Asian bubbles bursting in the 90s and then the subprime meltdown a decade later, and now we're seeing the bubbles bursting in Ireland, Portugal, Greece, and God knows Italy and Spain. What I would add to this is, and I don't know whether you've, I think she's a Canadian, by the way, Naomi Klein's book, Crisis Capitalism, or The Shock, it's called The Shock Doctrine.
The Shock Doctrine, yes. Naomi's a friend of mine.
She is. Well, I would suggest that you have to add that to that scenario that you just gave. I mean, what is so, I think, grotesque is that these predators who's caused these problems are able to capitalize on them. And
well, the cause of the problems is systemic.
Right.
It isn't Milton Friedman and Hayek and Ayn Rand who caused the crisis. They are partisans of the rich. They are partisans of the people who do decide now in a very undemocratic manner what's going to be invested and where, and those are those who have capital. And yes, they try to produce the kinds of policies that will benefit those people. And they use crises in order to benefit them all the more. And yes, that's what's happened in the wake of this crisis, where, as I said, it's the banks who've come out more powerful, and where corporations are actually floating in profits. They've got a big cash surpluses, but they aren't investing them in employing people. And so it isn't that these people caused the crisis. There's been a tendency on the liberal left and beyond in the last couple of decades to speak as though the problems are created by the way these kinds of people think. And the problem with that is that even when you put someone like Obama in, you get similar problems arising. These are structural, systemic problems in capitalism in which there is less and less room for maneuver for reform. Partly, yes, because of the strength of the right, their ability to buy power, if you like. But not only that, they have that strength precisely because the system cannot be equilibrated. The system cannot be made more equal without it creating crises of a different kind.
So the fact that we have one of the richest guys in America writing an op-ed saying, I need to be taxed more, the fact that it does seem that we're in a new gilded age and that there is a manifest evidence that our democracy is slipping into a plutocracy, that whether these people create these crises or not, they certainly benefit in the sense that
right. The
richest people are the billionaires like
Absolutely. The
Kochs who don't pay taxes or pay very little, and more, I think, to the point, the hedge fund people who certainly exploit crises, they only pay 15% tax, and in fact, they get to defer it indefinitely. And this is some of what Warren Buffett was talking about in his recent article in the New York Times.
Right.
So explain why is that happening.
One has to hope that people with a sense of decency even if they're capitalists. And, you know, most capitalists don't lay off workers because they like eating babies for breakfast. They do so because they're in competitive relationships with other capitalists. You know, one hopes that they increasingly will orient themselves to thinking less of how to maximize their profits and to thinking a little bit more about the welfare of humanity. And fundamental change has often taken place historically by people from the ruling classes or people supported by the people that they support as intellectuals or as newspapers, finally getting fed up with this irrational and unequal system. You know, that goes all the way back in the American case to Roosevelt, who, you know, was a patrician politician, but who welcomed the hatred of American business in the 1936 inaugural address and said, "I welcome it. What I'm introducing, yes, impinges on them, and it ought to impinge on them."
Well,
and one has to hope, finally, that Americans will produce the kind of politics that will be able to win over not only the marginalized communities of East L.A., but will be able to win over that well of decency that lies within most human beings. And it's been their inability to do that that has been the tragedy of left parties, the Democratic Party, the Labor Party in Britain, the Socialist Party in Greece, et cetera. They've increasingly not been able to provide a vision of a different kind of world that would appeal across class, even if it's based fundamentally on the people who are most screwed in this system.
Well, of course, you probably know, Leo Benish, that a lot of commentators on the left have, you know, and there's a lot of disillusionment and despair on the left, feeling that Obama has abandoned them. And one of the narratives is that if only he were more like FDR and did welcome their scorn instead of
yeah,
in fact, playing ball with Wall Street. And after all, the fact that he never came out of the gate saying who destroyed the economy and who's culpable, he left that on the table, and the Tea Party picked up that anger at Wall Street and ran
absolutely
with it.
Absolutely. I'm one of those Canadians, and there are many, many people outside the United States who know very well that the empire decides what's going to happen to the rest of the world, who constantly hope that a Democratic candidate is finally going to at least have the confidence of a Franklin Roosevelt. And I even hope that with Carter. And sure, one was hoping it with Obama.
Well, the point I wanted to make there, Leo, is that he's a smart enough guy, and I think he does have the sense of decency that you referred to, but he's also cautious about coming across as an angry black man, which would give Fox News a field day if that were to happen. So he's a little bit, I think, trapped. But let me just go back though to the statements just by Nouriel Roubini on Wall Street in the Wall Street Journal, just to get a sense of this, to get back to the subject of the disconnect between what we understand about economics and how we are literally taking steps that are going to almost guarantee a double dip recession and the wholesale impoverishment of millions of our fellow Americans for no good reason, and yet politically we seem incapable of understanding it. Let me just play a clip of Roubini's analysis of how austerity and low taxes, because let's face it, the obsession and the debate in this country has been hijacked by this deficit hoax. But the people who ran up the deficit, half of the debt was run up by three Republicans, Bush Senior and Junior and Reagan.
Yep.
And the current political climate, everybody should understand the simple logic of economics is that if you have a debt, the way to pay down the debt is with revenues. But these Republicans are refusing to even embrace the possibility of revenues. And in a recent debate, they all got, you know, wouldn't even accept a 10-to-1 ratio of cuts to revenues. So that's the surreal situation. And let's just have a listen to the summary by Nouriel Roubini.
In the medium term, we need fiscal austerity by raising taxes and cutting spending.
Yeah.
But in the short run, we need more fiscal stimulus. And every country, including the U.S., is just doing the opposite. We're doing front-loaded fiscal austerity, and there'll be more of it after the S&P downgrade, because now the pressure on the super committee in Congress is going to be to cut spending even more.
Do you blame S&P for cutting the rating of the U.S.?
I don't blame them. I think probably, you know, was a bit of a mistake at the time and the moment when they did it. It's true that the U.S. fiscal path is not sustainable, and it's true that the gridlock politically is such that we're not going to get much progress on, in the medium term, you know, getting deficit reduction. But the consequence of the downgrade is there'll be even more pressure for front-loaded fiscal consolidation, and that's recessionary. Every country from the UK to Eurozone is now doing front-loaded fiscal austerity, is getting into a recession. US, UK, Japan, Germany, the country who have not lost market access, should have more stimulus, not less stimulus, in the short run, while committing to having a medium-term fiscal sustainability that requires, among other things, raising taxes. Taxes today at 14% of GDP are the lowest we've had in the last 6 years. They used to be 19 on average. Now they're 14. How are we going to fill this fiscal gap without raising taxes?
And that was a clip of Nouriel Roubini talking to the Wall Street Journal, summarizing the state of the economy and ending up by suggesting that we're paying less tax now than we were just a decade ago. And the truth of the matter is, Leo Penish, we're about 34th in the world in terms of how much we're taxed in relation to GDP.
Yes, no, I think it's true. Although, you know, in order to have a Swedish type of welfare state, you need to have not only taxes on the rich, you need to have people prepared, working people, middle-class people, prepared to be taxed for the provision of collective services. The sales taxes in Sweden are over 20%. And people in Sweden have come to recognize that if they're going to have decent schools, a decent healthcare system, and moreover, those things provided in an egalitarian way, that they've got to be prepared to limit their individual consumption and opt for things that involve collective, democratically decided consumption. And so the problem, again, I want to come back to this, is not just a matter of the power of the wealthy in the United States. It's the way in which capitalist ideas and Randist ideas, if you like, permeate such an enormous portion of the population, obviously including those who watch Fox News. Now, at the same time, these very same people also recognize that they're being ripped off by Wall Street. If you ask them what they'd rather have, would they rather have higher taxes or better schools or better health care, they almost always answer better schools or better health care. So they reflect a tremendous, you know, mixture of political confusion that is a product of a very dysfunctional party system in the United States, with and indeed a media that all too seldom allows for the kind of discussion that you and I are having.
But I think that, Leo,
it's not surprising then that people both want to maximize their individual incomes and are open to appeals from the people who offer them less taxes, and identify to some extent with the wealthy who say we want less taxes, and at the same time want and need very badly these collective services.
But what I was going to add to that, though, is my sense that there's been a neutralization of a political class, of political activism, of political energy, that people have been detached from their political roots. The founding fathers clearly wanted a democracy in the beginning, but they at least empowered people as citizens, not as consumers. And inexorably, we become passive consumers instead of active citizens. And the extent to which we don't have a social democracy here, and what little we have is now being dismantled, I think is because people don't make the simple transaction. You vote, you pay your taxes, and you get your services. They've effectively made government the villain and detached people from that simple formula. And people in this country don't even know how much better off you guys are in Canada or people are in Australia. They're simply living in this cocoon.
Yes, but that's true. And it's very extreme in the United States. It has a very long history. It goes back to some of the founding fathers, at least. But you need to remember that Thatcherism articulated this far better than Reaganism did ideologically, with an enormous impact on the British working class in the 1980s. And heaven knows it hasn't been absent in Australia either, where the Labour Party has embraced a lot of this as well in the face of the tax revolt it faced in the 1970s. So again, I need to insist, and I think it's really important that Americans understand this, that the grass is not nearly as green in capitalist societies where you have, presumably, a social democratic variety elsewhere. You have very, very similar trends. They sometimes take more extreme forms in the United States. Maybe people speak more openly in the United States about being selfish and individualist in an Ayn Rand sense. But this problem is very deep. And the riots that took place in London last week, and the atavistic form that they took in relation to, you know, I can't consume what this society tells me I need to consume to be given, have any sort of dignity, is very much a reflection of this. This is not an American problem in the end. It is a problem of capitalism, and we increasingly see it around the world.
Well, I suppose the only qualification is that countries like New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and the Northern European social democracies in Germany and most of Europe at least have a more developed social safety net. So there's a little more cushioning.
Which
there.
Have not been easily dismantled.
Exactly.
That's right.
But given that socialism is such political kryptonite here in the United States, you have argued here that if you call for free public transit to be available, like public radio, public libraries, and public education and public health care, which the left has failed to do, and Obama certainly didn't deliver in his health care reform, you can make the argument, which some people did, I think, that this is actually may well save capitalism, because I recall when General Motors was going broke. They were going broke because of their healthcare costs in the private sector, and they were moving their plants to Canada, where there's a national health. So isn't there a logic to that?
Yes, there's a certain logic to it, no question. Although I assure you, General Motors won't be very keen on free transit. So General Motors wants to rid themselves of the private welfare state that they took on in the absence of a public welfare state in the United States. But heaven knows, the last thing they want is free public transit. Although, were there to be free public transit without the socialization of the banks and the corporations in the United States, you would soon find General Motors would be the ones who would be producing the vehicles, for free public transit. That type of conversion, which would be very sensible in terms of the ecological crisis, is something that is probably not going to take place, however, unless you have democratic economic planning and unless you change the balance of power very fundamentally in the States. Yes, there are things that are irrational in terms of capitalism, but because of competition, because of the difficulty of converting from one type of product to another type of product, capitalists are not nearly as rational as one would like them to be, not only in the sense of not paying their workers enough to consume the products they all produce, but also in the sense of not understanding that certain reforms are beneficial to the reproduction of profits. That said, in the end, those reforms, if they make workers too confident, if they give them something like full employment, if they give them a degree of distance from having to be capitalist consumers, that creates power on the part of people below, and capitalists don't like that either. So, the old Fabian difficulty of, the mistake of trying to convert the ruling class to socialism comes up here.
Right, but I'm also suggesting, Leo, that one has to look for allies where you can find them, and in a way. We talked earlier about the global warming and global climate change and the catastrophes ahead. Well, maybe we can form alliances. You've got the Koch brothers funding the denial of global warming,
right,
on the one hand, but you've got insurance companies on the other hand who realize they're going to go broke. So make an alliance with insurance companies. Does that make sense?
It does to some extent, but insurance companies and pension funds are those who have a very traditional banker's orthodoxy around not too much public debt. And insurance companies, of course, are major figures in the prevention of public health care in the United States because they make bucks out of private health care.
Which should not be called health care. It should be called sickness profit. I mean, as you know from George Lakoff, the left is disadvantaged semantically.
Yeah,
they don't frame things quite as cleverly as the right does.
Yeah, no, that's very, very true.
Leo Panish, we're going to take another brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with Leo Panish, the author of In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Leo Panish, who is a professor of political science at York University. He is the author of the new book, In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives. Let's go into the notion of left alternatives. And at the beginning of the interview today, I mentioned, Leo, this extraordinary a sense of disproportion here in the United States, where all the political activism seems to be on the far right and the right, and this the center is kind of I think insecure and ambivalent, and the left is just mute, and the far left, of course, is incoherent. What's going to Are politics Pavlovian? Do things have to get so bad and so, you know, the streets are on fire and you're stepping over people in the streets before people wake up?
Well, I think people are waking up, whether they are able to direct their disgust in useful ways is another question. From what happened in Wisconsin in the face of the attempt to destroy public sector trade unionism, to what's happening around the world as we see it, is that people are not lying down and taking it. And I think one's going to see that increasingly in the United States as well. The question is, can it go anywhere? And I do believe that it is entirely possible to go beyond the very populist and left liberal response, in which I would include Rubini and Krugman and Stiglitz, et cetera, who don't take people far enough, even when they give us clear analyses of the limits of the policies being followed.
But Leo,
in response to this crisis, as far as the left went, was to increase the regulation on Wall Street, and to limit the amount of bonuses or salaries of Wall Street executives. Those were the most radical proposals put forward. Even Rubini, when 2 years ago he called for nationalizing the banks, immediately said what he meant by that was that they should be nationalized, cleaned out, and then given back to the private sector. Whereas what, in fact, the response of the left to the crisis needed to be, and it has very much to do with how public transit would be funded of a free kind, how the ecological crisis would be addressed, how the economy would be converted into a sane, ecologically sound economy. You need to take the banking system, which after all is our money. It's our pension funds, it's our salaries that fuel what the banks then use to grease the wheels of capitalism. The banking system needs to be a public utility. It's been apparent since the 1930s that since you can't have deposit-taking institutions without also having publicly guaranteed deposit insurance, why should the banking system be private? If the role of the state is constantly to be act as lender of last resort to a private banking system, well, isn't it rational in that sense, and shouldn't we be able to appeal to people on the grounds of taking the banks into the public sector and making, in that sense, the resources that pass through the financial system available to democratic decisions about employment, about investment, about what is produced, where it's produced, etc. And it's been astonishing how these voices, these very intelligent voices on the American left, simply draw back from that. Now, as you say, it does have something to do with the fear of being called a socialist or a communist, that old McCarthyist red-baiting thing. And I think not only Americans, but the whole world has suffered by virtue of the success of this as a politics in the United States. But it leads, therefore, the effect of it is to disarm the left of providing solutions to people even when they're fed up. And that has to be overcome. People have to be prepared to gain the confidence to stand up, even in the United States, to Fox News, and say, what I'm putting forward is a democratic possibility. Indeed, it is the natural outcome of a democracy that the economy should not be in private bankers' hands.
Well, just to add to what you just said, Leo, in terms of the socialism being political kryptonite here in the United States, of course, it didn't. Stalin and the Soviet Union and North Korea today, et cetera, that didn't do it any good, or Cuba, which the left seems to be enthralled with Castro and Chavez. So, you know, now some of our revolutionaries in the left here think that Gaddafi's a great guy. You know, he's a real revolutionary hero instead of a murderous kleptocrat. So there's a lot of confusion on the left. But just to go back to what you were saying a minute ago about the signs of trouble and discontent with the London riots, et cetera, that is certainly nothing to consider as a positive sign. I mean, the idea that young kids, they're striking a blow for a new politics by stealing a pair of Nikes and Adidas from a fancy store is just pathetic.
Well, the only positive thing one can take out of that is that it shows you the depth of the failure of New Labour, of Blairism, who operated on the basis of the ideology of embracing Thatcherism so long as everyone could benefit from it, as though young blacks in Notting Hill or Birmingham could all become consumers in Chelsea, in London. And that illusion, I think that mendacity, is now coming home to roost. And it therefore forces upon the left, including the British Labour Party, a reconsideration of what the hell they were doing. They need to re-embrace the notion of class in a positive way. Class in the sense of there is a potential collective strength, especially insofar as that class would benefit from being pluralist in a racial sense, in an ethnic sense, in a gender sense, rather than being the white male working class that was often conceived of, and be prepared to put forward policies that would benefit the collective services that that class needs. What Blairism encouraged was you can all be consumers. Indeed, you can all be investors. And the result of that is that not only people speculated on their homes by taking out mortgages in the ludicrous expectation that their housing values would constantly go up and they could consume off of that, But you, that you can all be investors, and that you all are there, sort of part of the City of London, and that you are also all part of this wonderful consumption of West End London. Well, of course it was an illusion, and it's now coming out in the form of these morbid symptoms of young black, I must say not only black kids, going to the high street and giving themselves in these riots some of, you know, some baubles. Now, in this sense, one also has to say, what does the British state do? The British state responds by throwing a woman in jail for 6 months for having stolen a crate of water.
Well, they're
going to make examples of them.
Sure.
There's nothing positive about breaking a window and stealing. I totally agree. But there are social explanations for it.
Right.
That the way in which the left responded to Reaganism and Thatcherism, which was to try to become a left wing of it, has proven to be an utter failure.
Well, let's in the last 10 minutes or so, get into the your thesis. Now, you're critical of the Michael Moore type of populism that broke out after the meltdowns of 2008, where the refrain was, you know, don't bail out the banks, let them go under, and you point out that of course, is utterly irresponsible, that the savings of workers, let alone their paychecks deposited there, would be out the window, and not to mention the roof over their heads. Given and by the way, you'd mentioned how the left in England bought into Thatcherism. There's nothing more pathetic than the idea that Bill Clinton laid the groundwork for George Bush's so-called ownership society that ended up with the subprime looting, this vast Robin Hood in reverse, where aspirational minority people in this country thought they were getting a part of the American dream only to get ripped off, and now they're all living in their cars. But let's talk about what you're suggesting here, that the left has been more oriented to attempting to hold on to things than to taking things in a new direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think trade unions in particular, but the left much more generally, have mainly over the last, in the face of the attacks on the welfare state and on the New Deal over the last 30 years, have been in a completely defensive mode. And I think one of the reasons that they have been so defeated is that they're only defensive. They offer no confident future vision. And obviously one can't expect that you're going to offer people a socialist utopia and have them believe you, but you have to speak to their immediate needs and immediate demands. And as I said before, when you look at the American opinion polls, people respond very positively when they are concretely asked about whether they want better schools, better highways, better public housing, free transit, et cetera, very positively. At the same time, of course, they respond positively to lower taxes. And a left that was prepared to make the case for the collective services that people need and want, and be confident enough to say you can only have these if you take the banking system into the public domain, and if you're prepared to embrace the notion of democratic planning, not a government that you see as alienated from yourself, but a government that involves indeed a massive restructuring of the state so that it isn't something that you see that you're afraid of, but something you see as your own, which involves a tremendous change inside the state, not just a tremendous change in the market. I think that people would be prepared to hear it. I'm not saying that this is something that would happen tomorrow. But if you connect people's immediate needs and demands to the larger framework of who has power in a capitalist market society and talk about why it's important that the resources that are in the hands of the biggest corporations and banks be in the hands of a democracy, I think people will respond to it. It may take decades, but heaven knows, you know, you were speaking of the reforms that social democrats introduced decades ago. That came out of the building of labor movements and labor parties and social democratic parties from the 1880s to the 1940s. And without that building over 50, 60 years, it wouldn't have happened. But Leo, that's what we need to embark on.
But how do you go on the political offensive instead of being defensive in a political system that has been captured by money?
You're doing it. You're interviewing me.
I know, but I wish there were more listeners and we weren't on, you know, literally on the fringes of the media here because, you know, they're even trying to cut money from public radio here in the
United States. This has been historically the problem. The problem of the left, of progressive people, of socialists in capitalist societies. Of course, it's the problem of people who opt for democracy and freedom in authoritarian non-capitalist societies. But it's done. Change occurs.
But if you have a system as we have in the United States, which is based on money, they have taken over politics by making it about money. That means the people with money own the politics. It's that simple. And the Supreme Court just absolutely laid that down and opened the floodgates of corporate money with the
nevertheless, citizens. One has to keep plugging away.
But how do you compete without
money? I watched
money?
The film last night on the organization of the Pullman car work. The Pullman car blacks, the first black union in the United States. Philip Randolph was the leader of that struggle. It took a decade and a half to organize those workers. Finally happened in 1935. Someone saying in the early 1920s, what are you trying to do to organize the black porters of the Pullman car company? Would have made the same point. Certainly in the 1920s in terms of who pays for politics and owns politics, who can get a public hearing. It takes time. It takes dedication. That struggle was largely undertaken by black communities putting resources into that union over a decade. However poor they were, they put resources in, whether it was $10 a year, you had black people doing that, not only the black porters. And a victory eventually ensues. A shift in the balance of forces takes place in the context of the types of crises we're talking about. That involves new forms of media. That's absolutely right. Randolph had a newspaper called The Messenger, which was important in this. It'll involve trying to wean people off Fox News and other forms of media onto forms of media that will be more useful to this long-term struggle. There's no other way. There'll be explosions in the interim of a kind that will not always take a positive form, but will reflect people's discontent. And those of us who are committed to this long, difficult democratic struggle will have to try it as best we can to turn those explosions in a positive rather than in a negative way. But there's no alternative. In fact, I increasingly take the view that life's not worth living unless one believes that slowly one can develop that capacity for changing the world.
Well, I appreciate you joining us here today, Leo Panitch, and I appreciate the conversation. And I've been speaking with Leo Panitch, who is professor of political science at York University. He's the co-founder and board member of the Journal Studies in Political Economy. His books include Renewing Socialism, Democracy, Strategy, and Imagination, Global Capitalism and American Empire, American Empire and the Political Economy of Global Finance, and yearly editions of the Socialist Register. His latest book is In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives. Again, thanks for joining us, Leo Panitch.
Good to talk to you.
I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.